Katinka von Felder sat up and frowned at Zelda, her old nurse. "Why have you woken me so early?" she demanded petulantly, and tossed the tumble of golden curls back from her face. Even so freshly aroused from sleep, it was rosy and angelic. Her eyes were of a startling violet colour, like the lustrous wings of a tropical butterfly. "There is another ship near us, another company ship, the first we have seen in all these terrible stormy weeks. I had begun to think there was not another Christian soul left in the whole world," Zelda whined. "You are always complaining of boredom. It might divert you for a while." Zelda was pale and wan. Her cheeks, once fat, smooth and greased with good living, were sunken. Her great belly was gone, and hung in folds of loose skin almost to her knees. Katinka could see it through the thin stuff of her nightgown. "She's puked away all her fat and half her flesh," Katinka thought, with a twinge of disgust. Zelda had been prostrated by the cyclones that had assailed the Starnfastigheid and battered her mercilessly ever since they had left the Trincomalee coast. Katinka threw back the satin bedclothes and swung her long legs over the edge of the gilded bunk. The cabin had been especially furnished and redecorated to accommodate her, a daughter of one of the omnipotent Seventeen, the 17 directors of the company. The decor was all gilt and velvet, silken cushions and silver vessels. A portrait of Katinka by the fashionable Amsterdam artist Peter de Hoogh hung on the bulkhead opposite her bed, a wedding present from her doting father. The artist had captured her lascivious turn of head. He must have scoured his paint pots to reproduce so faithfully the wondrous colour of her eyes and their expression, which was at once both innocent and corrupt. "Do not wake my husband," she cautioned the old woman, as she flung a gold brocade wrap over her shoulders and tied the jewelled belt around her hourglass waist. Zelda's eyelid drooped in conspiratorial agreement. At Katinka's insistence, the governor slept in the smaller, less grand cabin, beyond the door that was locked from her side. Her excuse was that he snored abominably, and that she was indisposed by the mal de mer. In truth, caged in her quarters all these weeks, she was restless and bored, bursting with youthful energy, and aflame with desires that the fat old man could never extinguish. She took Zelda's hand and stepped out onto the narrow stern gallery. This was a private balcony, ornately carved with cherubs and angels, looking out over the ship's wake and hidden from the vulgar eyes of the crew. It was a morning dazzling with sunlit magic, and as she filled her lungs with the salt tang of the sea, she felt every nerve and muscle of her body quiver with the impetus of life. The wind kicked creamy feathers from the tops of the long blue swells and played with her golden curls. It ruffled the silk over her breasts and belly with the caress of a lover's fingers. She stretched and arched her back sensuously like a sleek golden cat. Then she saw the other ship. It was much smaller than the galleon, but with pleasing lines. The pretty flags and pennants that streamed from her masts contrasted with the pile of her white sails. She was close enough for Katinka to make out the figures of the few men that manned her rigging. They were waving a greeting, and she could see that some were young and clad only in short petticoats. She leaned over the rail and stared across. Her husband had commanded that the crew of the galleon observe a strict dress code while she was aboard, so the figures on this strange ship fascinated her. She folded her arms over her bosom and squeezed her breasts together, feeling her nipples harden and engorge. Oh, she wanted a man. She burned for a man. Any man. Just as long as he was young and hard and raging for her. A man like those she had known in Amsterdam before her father had discovered her taste for strong game and sent her out to the Indies. To a safe old husband who had a high position in the company and even higher prospects. His choice had been Petrus Jacoba van der Velder, who, now that he was married to Katinka, was assured of the next vacancy on the company's board, where he would join the pantheon of the Seventeen. "Come inside, leafling," Zelda tugged at her sleeve. "Those ruffians over there are staring at you." Katinka shrugged off Zelda's hand. But it was true. They had recognized her as a female. Even at this distance, their excitement was almost palpable. Their antics had become frenzied, and one strapping figure in the bows took a double handful of his own crotch and thrust his hips towards her in a rhythmic and obscene gesture.
"Revolting. Come inside," Zelda insisted. "The governor will be furious if he sees what that animal is doing."
"He should be furious that he cannot perform as nimbly," Katinka replied angelically. She pressed her thighs tightly together, the better to savour the sudden moist warmth at their juncture. The caravel was much closer now, and she could see that what the seaman was offering her was bulky enough to overflow his cupped hands. The tip of her pink tongue dabbed at her pouting lips.
"Please, mistress."
"In a while," Katinka demurred.
"You were right, Zelda. This does amuse me." She raised one white hand and waved back at the other ship. Instantly, the men redoubled their efforts to hold her attention.
"This is so undignified," Zelda moaned.
"But it's fun. We'll never see those creatures again. And being always dignified is so dull." She leaned further out over the rail and let the front of her gown bulge open. At that moment there was a heavy pounding on the door to her husband's cabin. Without further urging, Katinka fled from the gallery, rushed to her bunk and threw herself upon it. She pulled the satin bedclothes up to her chin before she nodded at Zelda, who lifted the crossbar and dropped into an ungainly curtsy as the governor burst in. He ignored her, and belting his robe around his protruding belly, waddled to the bunk where Katinka lay. Without his wig, his head was covered by sparse silver bristles.
"My dear, are you not well enough to rise?"
"The captain has sent the message. He wishes us to dress and stand to. There is a strange vessel in the offing, and it is behaving suspiciously." Katinka stifled a smile as she thought of the suspicious behaviour of the strange seaman. Instead, she made a brave but pitiful face.
"My head is bursting, and my stomach..."
"Oh, my poor darling." Petrus van der Velde, governor-elect of the Cape of Good Hope, bent over her. Even on this cool morning his jowls were basted with sweat, and he reeked of last evening's dinner, Javanese curried fish, garlic, and sour rum. This time her stomach truly churned, but Katinka offered her cheek dutifully.
"I may have the strength to rise," she whispered, "if the captain orders it."
Zelda rushed to the bedside and helped her sit up, and then lifted her to her feet, and with an arm around her waist led her to the small Chinese screen in the corner of the cabin. Seated on the bench opposite, her husband was afforded only vague glimpses of shining white skin from behind the painted silk panels, even though he craned his head to see more.
"How much longer must this terrible journey last?" Katinka complained.
"The captain assures me that with this wind holding fair, we should drop anchor in the Table Bay within 10 days.
"The Lord give me strength to survive that long."
"He has invited us to dine today with him and his officers," replied the governor. "It is a pity, but I will send the message that you are indisposed." Katinka's head and shoulders popped up over the screen.
"You will do no such thing," she snapped.
Her breasts, round and white and smooth, quivered with agitation. One of the officers interested her more than a little. He was Colonel Cornelius Schroeder, who, like her own husband, was en route to take up an appointment at the Cape of Good Hope. He had been appointed military commander of the settlement of which Petrus van der Velde would be governor. He wore pointed moustaches and a fashionable Van Dyck beard, and bowed to her most graciously each time she went on deck. His legs were well turned, and his dark eyes were eagle-bright, and gave her goose pimples when he looked at her. She read in them more than just respect for her position, and he had responded most gratifyingly to the sly appraisal she had given him from under her long eyelashes. When they reached the Cape, he would be her husband's subordinate, hers also to command, and she was sure that he could relieve the monotony of exile in the forsaken settlement at the end of the world that was to be her home for the next 3 years.
"I mean," she changed her tone swiftly, "it would be churlish of us to decline the captain's hospitality, would it not?"
"But your health is more important," he protested.
"I will find the strength."
Zelda slipped petticoats over her head, one after another, 5 in all, each fluttering with ribbons. Katinka came from behind the screen and raised her arms. Zelda lowered the blue silk dress over them and drew it down over the petticoats. Then she knelt and carefully tucked up the skirts on one side to reveal the petticoats beneath, and the slim ankles clad in white silk stockings. It was the very latest fashion. The governor watched her, entranced. "Oh, if only the other parts of your body were as big and busy as your eyeballs," Katinka thought derisively, as she turned to the long mirror and pirouetted before it. Then she screamed wildly and clutched her bosom, as from the deck directly above them there came the sudden deafening roar of gunfire. The governor screamed as shrilly and flung himself from the bench onto the oriental carpets that covered the deck. "De Standvastigheid." Through the lens of the telescope, Sir Francis Courtney read the galleon's name off her high gilded transom. "The Resolution." He lowered the glass and grunted. "A name which we will soon put to the test." As he spoke, a long, bright plume of smoke spurted from the ship's upper deck, and a few seconds later the boom of the cannon carried across the wind. Half a cable's length ahead of their bows, the heavy ball plunged into the sea, making a tall white fountain. They could hear drums beating urgently in the other ship, and the gun ports in her lower deck swung open, long barrels prodded out. "I marvel that he waited so long to give us a warning shot," Sir Francis drawled. He closed the telescope and looked up at the sails. "Put up your helm, Master Ned, and lay us under his stern." The display of false colours had won them enough time to duck in under the menace of the galleon's crushing broadside. Sir Francis turned to the carpenter, who stood ready at the stern rail with a boarding axe in his hands. "Cut her loose," he ordered. The man raised the axe above his head and swung it down. With a crunch, the blade sliced into the timber of the stern rail. The drogue line parted with a whiplash crack, and free of her restraint, the Lady Edwina bounded forward, then heeled as Ned put up the helm. Sir Francis's manservant, Oliver, came running with the red-quartered cloak and plumed cavalier hat. Sir Francis donned them swiftly and bellowed at the masthead, "Down with the colours of the Republic, and let's see those of England!" The crew cheered wildly as the Union flag streamed out on the wind. They came boiling up from below decks like ants from a broken nest and lined the bulwarks, roaring defiance at the huge vessel that towered over them. The Dutchman's decks and rigging swarmed with frantic activity. The cannons in the galleon's ports were training around, but few could cover the caravelle as she came flying down on the wind, screened by the Dutchman's own high counter. A ragged broadside thundered out across the narrowing gap, but most of the shot fell wide by hundreds of yards, or howled harmlessly overhead. Hal ducked as the blast of a passing shot lifted the cap from his head and sent it sailing away on the wind. A neat round hole had appeared miraculously in the sail 6 feet above him. He flicked his long hair out of his face and peered down at the galleon. The small company of Dutch officers on the quarter-deck were in disarray. Some were in shirt-sleeves, and one was stuffing his nightshirt into his breeches as he came up the companion ladder. One officer caught his eye in the throng. A tall man in a steel helmet with a Van Dyck beard was rallying a company of musketeers on the foredeck. He wore the gold-embroidered sash of a colonel over his shoulder, and from the way he gave his orders and the alacrity with which his men responded, seemed a man to watch, one who might prove a dangerous foe. Now at his bidding, the men ran aft, each carrying a murderer, one of the small guns especially used for repelling boarders. There were slots in the galleon's stern rail, into which the iron pin of the murderer would fit, allowing the deadly little weapon to be traversed and aimed at the decks of an enemy ship as it came alongside. When they had boarded the Heilige Nacht, Hal had seen the execution the murderer could wreak at close range. It was more of a threat than the rest of the galleon's battery. He swiveled the falconet and blew on the slow match in his hand. To reach the stern, the file of Dutch musketeers must climb the ladder from the quarter-deck to the poop. He aimed at the head of the ladder as the gap between the two ships closed swiftly. The Dutch colonel was the first up the ladder, sword in hand, his gilded helmet sparkling bravely in the sunlight. Hal let him cross the deck at a run and waited for his men to follow him up. The first musketeer tripped at the head of the ladder and sprawled on the deck, dropping his murderer as he fell. Those following were bunched up behind him, unable to pass for the moment that it took him to recover and regain his feet. Hal peered over the crude sights of the falconet at the little knot of men. He pressed the burning tip of the match to the pan and held his aim deliberately as the powder flared. The falconet jumped and bellowed, and as the smoke cleared he saw that five of the musketeers were down, three torn to shreds by the blast, the others screaming and splashing their blood on the white deck. Hal felt breathless with shock as he looked down at the carnage. He had never before killed a man, and his stomach heaved with sudden nausea. This was not the same as shattering a water cask. For a moment he thought he might vomit. The Dutch colonel at the stern rail looked up at him. He lifted his sword and pointed it at Hal's face. He shouted something up at Hal, but the wind and the continuous roll of gunfire obliterated his words. But Hal knew that he had made a mortal enemy. This knowledge steadied him. It was no time to reload the falconet. It had done its work. He knew that that single shot had saved the lives of many of his own men. He had caught the Dutch musketeers before they could set up their murderers to scythe down the borders. He knew he should be proud, but he was not. He was afraid of the Dutch colonel. Hal reached for the longbow. He had to stand tall to draw it. He aimed his first arrow down at the colonel. He drew to full reach, but the Dutchman was no longer looking at him. He was commanding the survivors of his company to their positions at the galleon's stern rail. His back was turned to Hal. Hal held off a fraction, allowing for the wind and the ship's movement. He loosed the arrow and watched it flash away, curling as the wind caught it. For a moment he thought it would find its mark in the colonel's broad back, but the wind thwarted it. It missed by a hand's breadth and thudded into the deck timbers where it stood quivering. The Dutchman glanced up at him, scorn curling his spiked moustaches. He made no attempt to seek cover, but turned back to his men. Hal reached frantically for another arrow, but at that same instant the two ships came together and he was almost catapulted over the rim of the crow's nest. There was a grinding, crackling uproar, timbers burst, and the windows of the galleon's stern gallery shattered at the collision. Hal looked down and saw Abberley in the bows, a black colossus, as he swung a boarding grapnel around his head in long, swooping revolutions, then hurled it upwards, the line snaking out behind. The iron hook skidded across the poop deck, but when Abberley jerked it back, it lodged firmly in the galleon's stern rail. One of the Dutch crew ran across and lifted an axe to cut it free. Hal drew the fletchings of another arrow to his lips and loosed. This time his judgment of the windage was perfect, and the arrowhead buried itself in the man's throat. He dropped the axe and clutched at the shaft as he staggered backwards and collapsed. Abberley had seized another grapnel and sent that up onto the galleon's stern. It was followed by a score of others from the other bosuns. In moments the two vessels were bound to each other by a spider's web of manila lines too numerous for the galleon's defenders to sever, though they scampered along the gunwale with hatchets and cutlasses. The Lady Edwina had not fired her culverins. Sir Francis had held his broadside for the time when it would be most needed. The shot could do little damage to the galleon's massive planking, and it was far from his plans to mortally injure the prize. But now, with the two ships locked together, the moment had come. "Gunners!" Sir Francis brandished his sword over his head to attract their attention. They stood over their pieces, smoking, slow match in hand, watching him. "Now!" he roared, and slashed his blade downwards. The line of culverins thundered in a single hellish chorus. Their muzzles were pressed hard against the galleon's stern, and the carved, gilded woodwork disintegrated in a cloud of smoke, flying white splinters and shards of stained glass from the windows. It was the signal. No command could be heard in the uproar, no gesture seen in the dense fog that billowed over the locked vessels, but a wild chorus of warlike yells rose from the smoke, and the Lady Edwina's crew poured up into the galleon. They boarded in a pack through the stern gallery, like ferrets into a rabbit warren, climbing with the nimbleness of apes and swarming over the gunwale, screened from the Dutch gunners by the rolling cloud of smoke. Others ran out along the Lady Edwina's yards and dropped onto the galleon's decks. "Frankie and St. George!" Their war cries came up to Hal at the masthead. He saw only three or four shot down by the murderers at the stern before the Dutch musketeers themselves were hacked down and overwhelmed. The men who followed climbed unopposed to the galleon's poop. He saw his father go across, moving with the speed and agility of a much younger man. Abberley stooped to boost him over the galleon's rail, and the two fell in side by side, the tall negro with the scarlet turban and the cavalier in his plumed hat, cloak swirling around the battered steel of his cuirass.
"Frankie and St. George!" the men howled as they saw their captain in the thick of the fight, and followed him, sweeping the poop deck with ringing, slashing steel.